This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.
China considers billions in stimulus to help orchestrate an economic turnaround. Plus, Ukraine's military counteroffensive gathers steam, and Donald Trump's Republican primary rivals dial up their attacks.
We're starting to see that they realize that if they're going to have any shot of winning the nomination, they are going to have to confront Trump.
It's Friday, June 16th. I'm Luke Fargas with the Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Can government spending jolt China's economy? Following a series of interest rate cuts this week, we are exclusively reporting that Beijing is planning a range of major steps to revive the country's flagging economy, which could include billions of dollars in new spending. Wall Street Journal Asia economics reporter Jason Douglas is here now with a look at what could be on the table. Jason, interest rate cuts, we talked about them yesterday on the heels of disappointing new growth figures. You report there's a bunch of other challenges, though, that policymakers are looking at here, stemming from the U.S. and its allies restricting access to advanced computer chips. You've also got multinational firms rethinking China's role in global supply chains. Quite a bit to deal with there. What is under consideration to try and deal with that?
What we understand is that under discussion is a plan to issue about ₩1 trillion in central government bonds. That's about $140 billion. If they go ahead with this, the idea is that the money will be funneled to local governments to spend in infrastructure projects in their districts and possibly ease some of the debt burden on the more heavily indebted local governments. And the big hope is that this will reignite confidence in the economy and get people spending and get businesses investing again. There's a second measure under discussion as well, which is more squarely targeted at the property sector, which is really in the doldrums and has been for a while. And this is an effort to kind of spur a bit more activity in the market by scrapping restrictions that currently exist on people buying second homes in smaller cities. So on the face of it, quite a small little tweak there, but officials hope it could have a pretty big effect on the property market.
All right, so Jason, what are economists saying then about whether these measures are actually going to be enough to address the situation?
They're broadly welcoming these measures. They've been expecting some form of stimulus for a little while as the data has got worse. These precise measures, you do have to wonder if they're necessarily the right tools to fix what exactly is wrong with China's economy at the minute. So in infrastructure spending, for instance, they've already built a lot of infrastructure. There aren't that many obvious projects that need to be built that would necessarily be productive. Infrastructure spending is one aspect of the growth picture that's actually not doing too badly. The things that need to be revived in China's economy are things like private investment and then consumption. And on the interest rate cuts, which you mentioned, people think those will probably not do very much to really spur growth. They won't do any harm. They might help with confidence a little. But the problem that the Chinese economy has right now is that businesses don't want to borrow and invest. Private businesses don't want to borrow and invest. And consumers are getting a little bit reluctant to spend.
That was Wall Street Journal Asia economics reporter Jason Douglas in Singapore. Jason, thank you so much for the update.
My pleasure. Thank you.
In other China news today, U.S. memory chip maker Micron is planning to pump $600 million into expanding production in the country. Just about a month after major Chinese firms were banned from buying its products, which Beijing said posed a national security risk. Micron's CEO said that the investment demonstrates the company's commitment to China's business, which was described in a statement posted to social media as, quote, unwavering. And there is about to be more to watch in U.S.-China relations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is set to depart for a much-anticipated visit to China this weekend, with talks in Beijing scheduled for Sunday and Monday. The visit is part of a recent White House push to reestablish high-level exchanges. In other news moving the world today, Ukrainian troops have now reached Russian front lines in areas of the country seized by Kremlin forces, with the Ukrainian army saying it has regained control of some 38 square miles since the start of its counteroffensive operations. NATO defense ministers met in Brussels yesterday with the US, UK, Denmark, and the Netherlands, agreeing to deliver hundreds of short and medium-range air defense missiles and associated systems to Ukraine. Here was U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin.
We remain laser-focused on meeting Ukraine's urgent needs for ground-based air defense systems. And that's especially important since Russia has ruthlessly ramped up its missile and drone attacks over the past month against Ukraine's cities.
The U.S. legal case against FTX co-founder Sam Bankman-Fried just got a bit more complicated, with a federal judge ruling that the criminal charges against the crypto executive be split into two trials. Journal court reporter Corinne Ramey says this follows new allegations that Bankman-Fried conspired to commit bank fraud and bribe a Chinese official.
The two trials is due to ongoing litigation in the Bahamas, where Bankman-Fried was arrested in December. He was originally charged with 8 counts related to the implosion of FTX and consented to his extradition on those. But an extradition treaty between the two countries requires that the Bahamas prove the new offenses that were brought in further indictments. If the Bahamas doesn't approve the new charges, then prosecutors have said they'd drop those additional counts. That means he would, in fact, only face that one trial in October.
Prosecutors have twice expanded their case against Bankman-Fried since he was transferred to the U.S. from Bahamian custody in December, leading him to argue that without the consent of the Bahamas, the U.S. violated the terms of his extradition. The U.S. government's pandemic-era freeze on student debt payments is coming to an end on August 30th, as a part of the bipartisan debt ceiling deal signed in early June. This means that tens of millions of student loan borrowers will have to start paying their monthly student loan bills. WSJ Heard on the Street columnist Jinju Lee explains what the end of this government relief program means for younger consumers and the knock-on effect of them potentially pulling back on spending.
So once those bills come due for student loan borrowers, retailers that lean heavily on younger consumers could be in for an unpleasant surprise. What's striking is the extent to which younger consumers are already feeling pinched. Part of it is that their rent and mortgage payments went up a lot more. Bank of America data showed that their credit and debit card spending has actually been shrinking in recent months, whereas it's still growing for older Americans. So given the existing weakness, it seems like the return to paying back student debt could really put the kibosh on their discretionary spending habits.
Coming up, call them direct critics, subtle critics, or even barely critics. The point is, Donald Trump is facing increased fire from fellow Republicans running for president. Our look at how they're taking on the GOP frontrunner after the break.
ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kinda heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
In the wake of his indictment in the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case, former President Donald Trump is facing a new challenge, increasing criticism from fellow Republican candidates for president. Wall Street Journal national political reporter John McCormick has been keeping track of what the GOP field has been saying about Trump and whether their attacks will land. And he joins me now with more. John, for anyone who's not been following the Republican primary campaign closely yet, what is proving different, if anything, after this latest indictment in Florida compared to that indictment back in New York in March, when Republicans, if I remember correctly, largely decried the prosecution and were defending Trump quite vocally? Are things changing now, at least on this front?
Yeah, they're still defending Trump and criticizing the Justice Department for bringing the case, but some of them are starting to sort of show a little bit more bravery in terms of confronting Trump, saying if these allegations prove to be true, they're serious. There's something that voters should consider as they're looking at the primary field. And so that is different. And even before the indictment, we had started to see sort of added criticism of Trump from his Republican rivals in the race, which was sort of a new thing. And part of it had to do with the entries of some new candidates the week before the indictment.
All right. So, John, you have arranged Trump's opponents into three camps, starting with the somewhat small, what you call barely critical camp, which is composed of South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, Governor Doug Burgum of North Dakota, and Vivek Ramaswamy, an entrepreneur. They are essentially laying off of Trump entirely, is it?
Yeah, and especially Tim Scott is really basing his candidacy on being sort of this happy conservative warrior. And so it would be off brand for him to be critical of Trump. Even he, though, in the wake of the indictment said, hey, these could be very serious charges. So that was a little bit tougher than he's typically gone with Trump.
I don't know, is it perhaps telling that even that barely critical camp is becoming more so?
Yeah, no, and I think by the time we get really fully engaged by this fall and early winter, probably that camp could be close to empty.
Okay, so on the other end of the spectrum, you've got what you call the direct critics, and I want to hear from two of them, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and former Vice President Mike Pence, who are both heard here in the wake of former President Trump's recent indictment.
I remember, you know, Hillary had the emails with the classified, and my view was, well, gee, you know, as a naval officer, if I would have taken classified to my apartment, I would have been court-martialed in a New York minute. And yet they seem to not care about that. And is there a different standard for a Democrat Secretary of State versus a former Republican president? I think there needs to be one standard of justice in this country. Let's enforce it on everybody.
The American people deserve to know the reasons for this unprecedented action, and we also need to hear the former president's defense. Then each of us can make our own judgment.
All right, John, you've put Pence and DeSantis in the direct critic pool. Are we hearing it in those remarks, or is it coming through predominantly on topics other than this recent indictment?
Yeah, I think it's predominantly been other topics. When Pence got in the race as part of his announcement in Iowa last week, he was quite critical of the former president and basically said that Trump shouldn't be allowed to be in the White House again, that he's drifted away from conservative values and ideas, and that he just isn't qualified to be president and that they should move on to a new flavor of leadership. DeSantis has very much made this about sort of Trump's history, electoral history, that the party lost seats in 2018 in Congress, that it lost the White House in 2020. It had another 2022 midterm that was below sort of expectations. And so DeSantis has made it about, he calls it a culture of losing that he thinks the Republican Party has fallen under. And he doesn't always mention Trump's name, but he doesn't need to because everybody sort of knows that history.
There are two other candidates you put in this direct critics camp, the former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, who says the latest Trump indictment is, quote, a very strong case, end quote, that the GOP should respect the rule of law. And then you've got former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who's critical of Trump himself, but also, it seems, is advising other candidates about how they should go on the attack.
Yeah, very much so. I think Christie has made criticism of Trump the centerpiece of his campaign. He had a CNN town hall recently where really the focus was just so much on Trump and sort of his prosecution of Trump. Christie's a former federal prosecutor. He's pretty good on his feet, and he's also pretty good on the debate stage. We're going to see whether Christie will actually make the debate stage. I think he's confident that he will. But he may be sort of teaching the other candidates how to directly confront Trump, and he is very much egging them on. And he's saying, how can you ever surpass this guy in the primary race if you don't directly confront him?
Do we know how much appetite there is within the Republican primary voting base for criticism of Trump, the man really leading this race so far?
Yeah, well, and the man who has led the Republican Party really for the last 7 years, I don't think there's a huge appetite. You know, when you talk to voters in these early nomination states like Iowa and New Hampshire, they love Trump. Almost all of them will say, I love his policies. You know, maybe he should have his face on Mount Rushmore. He was such a great president. But almost all of them on the sort of the second beat will say, but I do worry he's got too much baggage. I worry that he has all this legal stuff surrounding him and the media has been so mean to him. And I'm not sure he can beat Biden. And so there's a lot of voters out there who are thinking, okay, you know, we love this guy, we loved his policies, but maybe there's another play here for us to make in terms of a stronger nominee who will take on Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee.
That was Wall Street Journal national political reporter John McCormick. John, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Air National Guardsman and accused classified document leaker Jack Teixeira has been indicted by a federal grand jury in Boston. Teixeira faces 6 counts of willful retention and transmission of national defense information, and a judge last month ordered him to remain in custody as he awaits trial. Teixeira hasn't yet entered a plea, and a lawyer for him declined to comment on his indictment. Let's get an update now on the situation in Sudan, 9 weeks into a battle for power between 2 of the country's top generals. In addition to the immediate violence of the war, trade and banking services have nearly collapsed, and a lack of food and drinking water has created a hunger emergency for many of Sudan's 46 million people. Nicholas Barrio covers East Africa and the Great Lakes region for the Wall Street Journal and says that the situation is also worsening hunger in neighboring South Sudan, Chad, and the Central African Republic, which import much of their food and fuel from Sudan.
The paramilitary force, which is commanded by General Dagalo, has been marauding all over the capital and mounting roadblocks and checkpoints and stopping the flow of cargo and other movements of people. So that has, in essence, brought everything to a standstill. It's been very hard for everyone, including traders, humanitarian workers, to move everything. So this has mainly affected these hospitals. In West Darfur, these children are dying because there are no medical supplies, there's no food, because aid officials, humanitarian workers, government officials have no access to and from most of these hospitals. So it's a really desperate situation for most of the residents.
Shares in Virgin Galactic have jumped 44% in late trading after the space travel company announced plans to offer commercial flights into space this month. A significant breakthrough for the 20-year-old company founded by Richard Branson. The company's first flight will be focused on scientific research and is set to take off between June 27th and June 30th. The news follows a difficult start to the year for Richard Branson after Virgin Galactic reported bigger-than-expected losses in its most recent quarter, while his satellite launch company Virgin Orbit filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in April. And Prince Harry and Meghan Markle are no longer in business with Spotify. The streaming giant and Archwell Audio, the production company started by the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, said they ended their partnership after 2.5 years, with Spotify also saying that it would not renew the Duchess's Archetypes podcast. The companies said they had mutually agreed to part ways, and according to a person familiar, conversations are ongoing for another home for Archwell content. And we should mention that Dow Jones, the publisher of the Wall Street Journal, has a content partnership with Gimlet Media, a unit of Spotify. And that's What's News for Friday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show while I rest my voice. I'm Luke Vargas with Wall Street Journal. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.